League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast. It's another special. Today, I've got a gold medal winner in my kitchen. It is indeed Amy Williams. Welcome to my kitchen, Amy.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Before we get into talking about Winter Olympics and your life, I'd like to give you a present. I give all my guests a present. Now, do you drink?
I love a red wine.
Oh,
so if that's what's hidden in there, I will have a little look.
Look, Amy, I know nothing I know nothing about red wine, but the guy in the shop who sorts me out always gives me nice ones.
Looks good to me. I can see through the red tissue paper. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
My guess always, because she's done really well for you there. So
Well, one of my Christmas presents was wine tasting from my husband.
Oh, how was that?
He hates white wine. We both drink red. And I'm like, I'm determined there's a white wine out there that you're going to like. So, yeah, a little tasting room. We've booked it up for next month or whatever. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
When you were an athlete at your peak, did you ever drink? Were you allowed to? No.
I personally was just really strict on myself. My diet, the fact of what was the point of beasting myself in the gym if then I filled my body with alcohol or the wrong kind of foods and not recover 100% to be able to get up and do the same thing the next day. I just didn't see the point of it. So, no, I went obsessive from when I missed out on the Turin Olympics 2006 for the next 4 years to Vancouver.
In case anyone doesn't know, you won the golden skeleton, which is going down the, what do you call that thing, the track?
The ice track. You were about to say tea tray. Like, it's on a tea tray. I met someone in the lift this morning. I was like, I have to use the word tea tray, but we hate using that. It's the skeleton sled. Very sophisticated.
Winter Olympics this year. Have you got your head around how to pronounce Pyeongchang?
I think I'm saying it right, but yeah, Pyeongchang.
You've been out there once already, haven't you?
Yes, I went out there, oh my goodness, was it last month or a little bit longer than that, to do the torch relay.
It was
amazing to go out there. So I wasn't quite in Pyeongchang. I think I was a bit more further south.
I've not been to that country yet. What's it like?
To be fair, the first thing that hit me was just how friendly everyone was. Korean people were just so smiley, so friendly, like went out of your way to help you. They were back then getting so excited about the Olympics. So.
All I know about South Korea, the two things I know about them is they're huge on technology. Did you notice that when you were there?
Definitely. Phones were out.
Seoul, apparently, it's huge. And also, Seoul is the place where there's most depression in the world, I believe.
Oh, really?
Or something. Yeah, because it's where Eastern culture meets Western culture.
Yeah.
And it's a confusing time for them all. So apparently.
Yeah.
That's according to Will Storr, who was one of the guests on this podcast. So
it's
not my knowledge. All right, we're going to talk more about that in a minute. But first of all, just to remind everyone, you did win the gold 2010 Olympics, Vancouver. There was no snow there. That's what I remember it for. Is that right? There was no snow.
Yeah, if I can vaguely remember 8 years ago, there was limited snow. And I believe that they had big warehouses on the ski slopes and they were like dumping snow out.
I tuned in for the snowboarding. It's the stuff that I really loved.
Yeah.
And they were just struggling everywhere with snow. And it was all just sort of this slushy stuff they were getting out. And they're all moaning about it.
I think that's the thing about Winter Olympics is the environment and the weather is huge. It plays such a massive part. Unless you're a closed sport, you know, you're in an ice skating rink or, you know, the curling, etc. The outside elements for bobsleigh, skeleton luge, the ski and the snowboarding, it's massive. So
I absolutely love the Winter Olympics, but it doesn't seem to have as big an effect here as obviously the other Olympics.
Mm.
Did you notice that when you went out in 2010?
Yeah, I think us winter athletes were used to not getting the same amount of media and press. And year on year, we have been so much more successful.
Yeah.
We've had more and more medals. And it's still quite sad for us to see that we're not on the back pages of newspapers. The media don't seem to write about it as much. And yet, you know, we have so many athletes winning World Cup medals, World Championships medals on a weekly basis every single winter.
Well, you put it on the map for us, really, didn't you? Because it's like, yeah, we're all glory hunters. Suddenly we've got a gold medal and we're like, yeah, we love that one.
Yeah, I do think
we
like
love the skeleton. That's our favourite. It's, yeah, like, it's like we love rowing at the moment and cycling. Yeah, we love, yeah, rowing and cycling because we win.
Yeah, Vancouver, it was amazing to be the person to bring home the medal. And it was great then that it highlighted winter sport. It kept the funding going. Then 4 years after that in Sochi, there was a lot more airtime. BBC, for example, put it a lot more on the TV. The athletes got that little bit more profile. And then it's kind of just got a little bit momentum for this game. So yeah, every year, I say every year, but it's clearly every 4 years, but in your brain. Yeah, yeah. So every 4 years, it does get a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger.
But you're right, because you know, I snowboard, so I like looking at that. I'm rubbish at it, by the way, but I like doing it.
Better than me.
And apparently we've got quite a lot of good snowboarders because they go inside.
Yeah.
You know, we do it in the what do they, snow domes and, yeah, stuff like that. So they're quite good at all the tricks and stuff. Yeah, you're right. I don't know any of their names, really. I know Amy Fuller, I think, and a couple, yeah, of Ben...
You've got Billy Morgan.
Right, okay.
Yeah, Billy Morgan, yeah.
And so, but they're not, the media aren't putting them in front of us enough, are they, at the moment?
No, and I think, yeah, I mean, between snowboarding and skiing, we're hoping for most of our medals to come from those athletes. So in the snowboarding, Katie Ormerod is one of the big names at the moment. She's quite a young athlete coming on through, and she's been winning our big air competitions. She's got World Cup medals. So she is out there, and when it all comes together on the day, I mean, she is definitely a medal contender. Yeah, you've got Jamie Nichols, who's actually her cousin. Then Billy, yeah, Morgan, Amy Fuller, who's been out there, and they've all been winning World Cup medals, yeah, throughout the last season and the last year.
Of course, we had, she won a medal last time, Jenny Jones.
Jenny Jones, who's, she's now amazing, just retired. So, yeah, I think we are getting better and better.
I interviewed her once, Jenny Jones, and she said, oh, Carl, I'm going to teach you how to do some jump type things. And she said, get your knees up to your chin. So I was doing it. She goes, no, get your knees up to chin. I was like, this is far as, yeah, they go. And she was going, no, you have to get your knees right up and then, yeah, you explode out. Like that's how you do it. And I'm going, I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'm so stiff now at my age.
Yeah. So, and I think they do a lot of their training on like trampolines.
Oh, if you follow
that. They're doing.
I like to follow that lot on Instagram. And, yeah, and so the stuff that lot get up to, they have the best lives ever.
It's amazing,
just,
isn't it?
Throwing themselves around. How did you get involved in the skeleton in the first place then?
Well, for me, my background, as a kid, I did every single sport, you know, a little, yeah, bit of everything. I was one of those annoying ones who just, like, put their hand at anything. And then I wanted to do athletics, so I joined a club. And where I live in Bath, in 2002, they had just built a start track, so for bobsleigh and skeleton. So basically, it's like train tracks with rubber mat on each side and a different kind of sled slots on, like almost on wheels.
Right.
And I remember watching the Salt Lake City Games in 2002, watching the skeleton, but never in a million years it going into my brain saying, oh, I need to have a go. But then literally one day, bored in the gym, whatever I was doing, got chatting to some guys, girls, they were bobsleigh athletes, skeleton athletes, and they were about to go down and do a training session on it. So I was like, oh, can I come and join in? Can I come and have a look? And then, yeah, happened to be pretty quick at it. And so I joined... I went out to Holland.
So what were you running then?
I wanted to do 400 metres because, right, I was like, that looks like the toughest track at the, you know, sprint, yeah, event. But I had a lot of shin splints and compartment syndrome in, right, in my shin. So I couldn't ever quite do all the longer distance endurance side of the training because I was in a lot of pain. So I kind of stopped and was like, oh, I really need to find another sport. I actually started doing modern pentathlon for a few months and, right, joined in with the training team, and they really wanted to take me on. But then I found skeleton, the push track, went out and did the World Push Championships and won my guest category. So then I was invited
to join.
That
was when you went to Holland?
Yeah, that was when I went to Holland.
What is the push championships? What happened?
Well, they don't do it anymore. So they, right, used to, in the middle of a little place called Groningen in Holland, set up a huge like scaffolding in the middle of a town centre, and they just did the World Push Championships for bobsleigh and skeleton, just for that like 30 metres. And I asked if I could enter as a guest for Great Britain. And I won my category. And I think I ended up coming second overall.
Sorry, so there's 30 metres and you just hold on to the bar and run?
Literally like the kind of a different kind of sled on wheels. So there's no ice involved. Yeah. And you just in that bent over position, pushing the sled, sprint as fast as you can, sort of dive on it. There's like a bungee system that kind of stops you. But then I joined an army ice camp because back then there was no other way of getting into the ice sport, so, yeah, bobsleigh, skeleton, luge. So yeah, I joined in like as a civilian, paid my way, went to Lillehammer in Norway and did a 2-week kind of school, like ice school. And
I fell in love with it.
To begin with, I wouldn't use the word love. No, you get beaten up black and blue, like head to toe in bruises. I think I remember biting the little end bit of my tongue off, being in tears. But then you were around these army people, like big bobsleigh girls, like trying to be macho. And I just remember thinking, I don't want to look like a wimp. Keep going.
Right.
And then like that slight addiction, like, okay, I don't want to hit 10 walls. I only want to hit 9 walls, etc. Until, yeah.
So where do you practice it then when you're starting out?
So then, Bath, which was my home. So that's where the summer training was, which is really important to have the start, the push track. And then in the gym, lifting weights every day. And then in the winter months, so pretty much from about end of September through to February, March, you're away on the ice. So that means traveling around the world. Every week or two, you're traveling to the next country, to the next track, and then you're competing. So it's a bit like your Formula One circuit. You know, the drivers rock up at a racetrack, train, race, pack up, move to the next place.
Yeah, but where are you practicing coming down the track?
So for example, Germany, there's 3 tracks around Germany. There's one in France, there's one in Austria, you've got one in Switzerland, America, you've got 2, Canada, there's 2. You know, splattered all around the world.
I'm going to be really ignorant here. Yeah. Are all the tracks the same or are they all different?
So imagine your Formula One circuits.
Right, okay.
Every track has, like in Skeleton, there's between 14 and 16 corners.
Right.
Every track is different, is unique. It could be a little bit we'd say like a gliding track, so gentle and smaller corners and easier to get down, but harder to get down fast. And then you could have tracks that have got massive G force pressure, huge corners, really fast. You could crash, you can hurt yourself. So they're quite different, like profiles of corners, designs of the track.
But are they all have to have a certain amount of corners then? And
yeah, I mean, they all roughly are, 14 to 19 corners, all roughly take anywhere from 50 seconds to 1 minute 10 to get down. They're roughly 70 to 80 miles per hour to 90 miles per hour speeds.
Are they all different gradients as well then?
Yeah, so most of them are about, again, like 1400 meters long up to 1800 meters long.
Right.
Some, yeah, have huge radiant drops, profiles of corners, the starts at the, you know, at the top when you're sprinting are different. Yeah, it's like massively technical, but it doesn't necessarily look it.
Could you do any winter sports before you started doing it? Were you a good skier or?
Nope, never skied, never been on a ski holiday, never really spent any time in the snow apart from what we have in the UK. Don't even like the cold. I just stumbled in it from living in that right place, giving a go at something, saying, yeah, I'm going to try that.
Can you ski now?
I have now been twice. In fact, just before Christmas, I went on my first ever little weekend away skiing and I had 2 lessons, a few hours on skis.
Because I suppose you weren't allowed to do it when you were doing Skeleton because the insurance or whatever.
Yeah, you're not allowed as an athlete. And actually, the Skeleton tracks aren't near like good ski places. You're not near a good ski hill. And then you don't have the time, physical time off to do it. And then you're not allowed. You don't want to get injured and all the rest
of
it.
Well, how does it work? How do you live off? Is there lottery funding for winter sports?
Yeah. So like when I first started, it was right, I'm going to move back home, live with mum and dad, try not to get them to make me pay rent, you know, like saving money. I worked in Thornton's chocolate shop. So I'd go and do my first training session when the gym opened at 6 a.m. Do my first session, go to the chocolate shop, you know, serve chocolates, work up in the cafe, make coffees, and then go back at the end of the day to do my next training session, eat dinner, go home, go to bed.
And is the training about the first 30 meters? Is that the training you're doing to get as quick as you can for that push? Is it what you call
the push? So yeah, our summer life, our summer training is all about being powerful, strong, explosive, and the fastest off the blocks. So for that 20, 30 meters of pushing, we are kind of like your 30 meter, 100 meter sprinters, but we never stand up. You know, we actually are always bent over, always in that bent over position, pushing. And a lot of core stability, because then when you're lying on the sled, it's been maintaining that body position in the perfect body position whilst those G forces are on you. And then, yeah, in the winter, it's all about learning and driving, learning how to drive the sled.
How's your back now?
Yeah, pretty knackered.
Is it?
Yeah. Crashes in my first few years.
Oh, is it crashes or not running with the bent back?
No, for me, it was bad crashes that slipped one disc. And then I have four degenerative bulging discs in my lower back, one in my neck, four major knee operations.
Wow.
Yeah, it's constant.
I was going to ask you why you retired, but I think I know. Was it injuries in the end?
I mean, there was quite a few different reasons, politics, etc., within the team. But the main reason was injuries, like waking up in pain every day, going to the physio, getting strapped up, having epidural injections twice a year, every year for like 8 years. I couldn't feel my right leg, my quad. Couldn't feel it. It was numb for years. So it was my sports doctor who was like, Amy, like, you've got your gold now. I really think you need to look after your body, look after it.
Is the feeling back in it now?
Yeah, my leg's back, but I'm still in... I still, every day, I'm in constant pain with my back,
Are you able to exercise at all now?
I do. I got massively into CrossFit, and then I was like, what am I doing?
Why are you doing that? You're punishing yourself again.
Exactly. I was like, your body. It's really competitive, which I kind of loved. Yeah. But then I was like, I'm squatting again, and the reason I stopped sport was because everything hurt. So yeah, I gave up on that. Then I found yoga and absolutely fell in love with yoga. Was doing it pretty much, every day.
So going back to when you're an athlete and you're doing it at your level, after the last Olympics, I had a lot of them on Sunday brunch and interviewed them. It seemed to me that now rest seems more important than exercise for these athletes. They're telling them all the time. They're actually monitoring them now and saying you're not allowed to leave the house and all you're allowed to do is sit and eat and watch TV. And also, I had Mia Krieger on this podcast, who's one of the leading sleep experts. I don't know if it's happening over here, but in America, they're trying to make their athletes sleep for longer because that's when your body repairs itself the most. So some of the athletes out there are sleeping for 12 to 14 hours because they're doing so much. They're doing two sessions, like you were saying, and then sleeping for long periods, sleeping in between, sleeping. Is that how it was for you as well, lots of rest period?
I mean, we weren't lucky enough to have any of that level of monitoring. Or when I was in it, we didn't have a nutritionist. We only even had a physio, like at major competitions. Whereas now there is more funding to be doing all this research and development. For me, like, I needed sleep because I struggle to sleep. I take ages to get to sleep. I'm a light sleeper. So I was always pretty much in my pajamas, 9:30 in bed, because I knew it took me quite a long time to actually fall asleep. And then, you do need that rest and the recovery to be able to get up. That's the thing I miss now. Having a baby, no sleep, like up all the time. But yeah, I mean, recovery is vitally important to feed your body with the best foods, protein. I was eating 5 to 7 meals a day, always with protein in it, because you can't beast yourself every single day.
So is the Winter Olympics team separate from the Summer Olympics team? Do they keep them very separate?
It is separate, and mostly because, you're traveling around the world maybe 6 months. Winter athletes, we have to live on the road.
Yeah, but I mean, do the summer athletes, your Mo Farahs and everything, do they get more support than the winter guys do?
On a whole, the summer sports do get more funding on a whole. And when you look at the individual amount and money given to each sport, but a lot of it is also on the mega. A lot of it is also on the medal targets that you have to get and how many medals. Medals mean money.
Yeah.
Money, but money means medals. If you don't have the money, you can't get the medals.
Doesn't make sense,
does it? So if you're actually, cutting funding from a certain sport, well, how on earth are they meant to go out, train, spend the time away, get medals because they haven't got the money to do it? So I think it's really hard, catch-22, that... Like how do you physically win and get medals if you haven't got the money?
In cycling, we invest a lot in, what do they call it? Small margins, is it called? Something like that. And we invest a lot in helmets and best bikes and everything. Mm. Your equipment, the sled, are they all different or are they all the same? Are we improving them? Are nations improving them? Or do you turn up and you all use the same ones?
So again, I kind of go back to, imagine your Formula One cars.
Yeah.
They're pretty much all the same, but they're also very different.
Right.
There is a massive fat rule book somewhere, that you have to get your equipment tested by the jury, etc. before a race. They all get stamped. Everything is checked to make sure it's within the rules. The Germans make their own sleds. The Americans have their own. The British have their own. Oh, so you, I couldn't phone up the Americans and say, hey, can I buy one of your sleds? Because it is top secret to those tiny details. We're talking millimetres could make all the difference. And in Great Britain, we started making our own sleds back in 2010. So my sled at Vancouver was a prototype sled. And then we've developed them from then. So probably if I looked at our sleds now, I wouldn't really recognise it because so much has changed in those 8 years. And we had McLaren Technologies come on, you know, just helping design, you know, that bolt could be designed differently to make it easier for the athletes to work on them. So these tiny little changes, and for us it's in the runners. So it's a bit like the tires on a car. We have the metal runners on the bottom of our sled that grip into the ice that have a knife cut into it. So that's like the tread on a car. So depending on different conditions, different air temperatures, humidity, ice temperatures, you might put on a different pair of runners. And that's where a lot of the money and research and technology goes.
It's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah.
And obviously the helmets, because you want to be as aerodynamic as possible.
Helmets, I mean, pretty much it's a bog standard UVEX helmet. They're the one company that make them, and every athlete pretty much buys into the same helmet. The Japanese guys went off and designed their own a bit. You know, you do little bits in wind tunnels?
But the cycling guys have their kits of the seams in a weird place, don't they? So they don't make sure there's no friction. Is that
I spent hours and hours in a wind tunnel. And most, it's horrible, I'm telling you. They were the most miserable days when you knew you had to drive to Southampton, to the university, go in the wind tunnel for hours, keeping that body position with blasting cold wind on you. I remember literally almost crying in my helmet because you were shaking, you were so cold. I would literally be drinking Lemsips on the way home with the heat in, full blast in the car. But anyway, it was worth it to find your perfect body position for you on your sled. If your head is that 1 centimetre higher or lower, or your shoulders rounded or flatter, or your feet an inch apart or close together, can make, you know, at set times on the track when you weren't up on a corner. So, I mean, you are talking 0.001% of a difference. But when that adds up for four runs during an Olympic race, and that can maybe make 1/100th of a second, that could be gold or silver.
How many? I thought you got judged on just the one race. Going down and they take your fastest
on
score.
On Olympics, you have 3 days of training, two runs a day. So you have 6 runs to learn the track. Right. And then it's race day. So you have 2 days of racing. And every one of those four runs counts. You can't drop a run or anything like that.
They add them up.
Yep, four runs.
Wow.
So it is the slider who is the most consistent. You can't have a phenomenal stormer of a run and then terrible another three, because they all count.
Yeah. Which is good, isn't it?
Consistent.
Yeah, because you don't want one freak run for someone to win it. You want the best one, and that's the best way of doing it. So, why did you decide to do skeleton rather than bobsleigh or luge or something? Why was that
bobsleigh? I mean, they're all like 6'4". Well, not the girls, the guys. Well, to be fair, the girls in America, Canada, Germany, they are literally 6 foot, 90 kilos.
Why is that? The heavier you are, the quicker you come down, right?
The power, the speed, the strength. Those bobsleighs weigh 200 odd kilos. They're probably heavier than that. Yeah, they are big girls, strong, powerful. And I'm not that. I tried my hardest to bulk up and put on a lot of muscle. So, and I don't know, like going feet first. Like when you watch luge athletes, so they're on their back with their feet first. When it goes wrong, it goes really wrong. And their legs are flying all over the place. They break their ankles.
But you're going with your head first. That to me seems more weird.
I don't know. It just felt normal. I don't know. I just didn't even consider anything else.
It is really dangerous though.
Yes and no. Like,
hold on, before your Winter Olympics, the Georgian skeleton
luge guy, 2 days he died.
Because I remember it happening and thinking, Christ, are they going to carry on with the Olympics? They had to, obviously. But it was and that's the reality where it really hits home when you guys are hurtling down there. You can die. It's that dangerous.
Like that did really hit home, and I remember at that moment like it was yesterday. It was a freak accident. he didn't have the same knowledge and skill and experience. He was a smaller nation, didn't have the same kind of coaching. And the track in Vancouver was the fastest ever built. The ice on the corners, they'd done a little bit differently. And yeah, I mean, it was a freak accident that... So when you make a mistake, it's that knock-on effect of a corner. And the experience comes from, if you make a mistake in corner three, the athlete that can get their sled back on the right sort of line, you know, is then the better athlete. So the knock-on effect, it just goes wrong and more wrong and further. And then freakily, yeah, he hit the side of the track in such a way that he flew out and happened to hit a metal post. And yeah, unfortunately, instant death. That is a complete fluke. I've never heard of it before.
Did it affect you guys?
It was really scary. It was frightening. And it made me think, oh my goodness, what am I doing? I'm spending my life just sliding down on my stomach like a penguin. Like, seriously, I'm choosing to do this. Is it really worth it? And I know it scared a lot of the bobsleigh athletes. And I know the Netherlands guys pulled out of the foreman, I think, because... it was like, is it worth it? What have the Canadians done to the track? Like, what, the ice profile was just so different, the speed. I mean, so they changed the luge competition to starting further down. So they just started a few corners further down, which made it slower.
Right.
Etc. But ours was the same. They offered us one extra training run from corner three. And only me, a Japanese girl and the Italian girl took it. So this was on our first day of training. But I was always, I wasn't the most confident slider. And I was like, I have to take it. Because for me, if I can use up all my nerves on that one run and then get to the top of the track and be like, okay, I'm alive, I can do it. So it's quite difficult because you don't want to practice further down the track because you'll reach each corner at a different speed. And so therefore the pressures and the way you steer are going to be different. But I was like, look, that doesn't matter. I'm just going to go down to feel confident, to get my own confidence in it. So, yeah, I decided to take the run. And I remember actually the two German girls who ended up coming second and third. I remember them coming up to me in the dining hall saying, Amy, why did you do that? Like, you're a good slider. You don't need, like, you're stupid. You don't waste your energy doing it. And I was just like, well, why not? Like, why not? They've given us a chance to do one extra run. Take it. I don't want to regret it. And then, yeah, when I got to the top of the track, I felt way more confident. Mm. And who knows if that made the difference.
How bad was the track, or good was the track, whichever way you look at it? Was it different?
It was different because, yeah, it was crazy fast. I mean, I got to 142 kilometres per hour. Like,
head first.
The process in your head of your reaction times was phenomenal. But I just kept telling myself, I have to love the speed. I have to love the speed. It was like a chant of, if I don't love the speed, how am I going to win?
What does it feel like going down at that speed?
It's a really hard thing to explain, actually. In one sense, there is this huge adrenaline, the thrill, the rush, the excitement, the nerves. And then on the flip side, you just don't think about it because you're doing a job. And you're standing at the top of the run, having done all your training runs, and all you're thinking about is physically, right, I'm standing next to my sled, I'm thinking about driving my knees forward because I'm starting and I'm pushing and to be explosive. Then I'm loading onto my sled and lying as still as possible, trying to get your heart rate down because your heart rate's pumping from the top. I'm going into corner one, right, what steers am I doing? And then you're straight into doing your steers because you do a lot of mental imagery. So when you're in the changing rooms ready to go out, you're shutting your eyes. I can go through any track in the world now in my head. I can see the corners. You're writing notes down. What steers am I doing? So when you're actually on the sled, you almost have to have this emptiness in the head because you've got to kind of declutter it. Mm. But at the same time, you're feeling what the ice is doing. You're using your peripheral vision. You're sensing the feelings of the ice through your sled and the pressures and doing your steers. Sometimes you get to the bottom, you're like, well, how did I get to the bottom? And then sometimes you're like, oh my goodness, that was fast. Or, oh crikey, I made a mistake in corner eight. Mm. Like, you're constantly, as soon as I finish a run, I get my notebook out and you're writing down, what did I do? What did it feel like? Did I hit a corner? Was I a little bit too far left in corner eight? You know, how did I come out? And you're trying to get that information down on paper.
Apparently we don't use our brains to the maximum capacity very often, and Megan Hine, who I've also interviewed on this podcast, she's a survival expert, she says that when you get put into dangerous positions, your senses come alive and everything sort of slows down. because you're in danger and you're actually using all your senses and your brain and everything. Is that what it feels like? Does it sort of, when you're going into a corner, does everything sort of slowly slow down for you because you're actually going so fast that all your senses are alive? And
yeah, I kind of get what she's saying. I think it's funny because when you've had a whole summer off and you go down the track for the first time on day one of the season, it is like being in a washing machine. It is so fast because your brain hasn't kind of got used to it. And then the more and more you slide throughout the winter season, everything does slow down. So what seemed really fast, rocking up to Vancouver for the first time that year, you're just like, whoa, how did I get to the bottom? That was too quick. The second time, the third time, the fourth time, everything does slow down because your reactions are speeding up. Then you're getting used to it.
A second for you is a long time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where a second for us is like, it came and went.
For
you, it's a long time, a second.
Yeah.
You're doing a lot in a second.
And it is funny how you can get to the bottom of the track and you really remember certain parts of the track as if it is in slow-mo, and then other bits were a blur.
What was the difference between first and second when you won in time?
I was over, I think I was 5,600, so more than... Yeah, I think I was 5,600 quicker.
What's that, a half second?
You know what, I've never even studied the time sheet.
You haven't?
I did win by quite a big margin races.
You're saying half a second? Ish.
Yeah.
And that's a big time margin, is it? It's nuts, isn't it?
Mental.
It's absolutely
the thing,
nuts.
And that's where we talk about marginal gains.
Yeah,
talk about... When I go off and do corporate talks and business talks, it's like, where's the 1%? Where can you get 1%, which 1% for us could be 0.001.
Yeah. So...
Of a second, you know what I mean? Like hundredths of a second, add up. I've won and lost a World Junior Championships to a German on a German track. I specifically remember it in Winterberg by 1/100th of a second. And I specifically remember I clipped into corner 9. I remember it like it was yesterday. Like,
How long is the actual? How long was your time down on the goal?
Oh, to be fair, this necklace that I've got around my neck today, which is of my Vancouver symbol, on the back is actually my winning time etched into it that
what?
My husband got made for me. Well, I actually can't remember. Like, you'd actually have to read it. I am so bad with numbers.
Well, roughly what is it?
If
how many seconds is it?
I was to ring up my coach. Oh, so we're talking like each run down was around 52 seconds.
So 52
that
and it comes
times
down
four.
To, and it comes down to half.
3 minutes something. And you're, you
right,
can,
okay, but it comes down to half a second in the it's
so,
unbelievable.
I mean,
oh, what, oh, hold on, half a second over four races?
Over four runs.
It's come down to half a second over four runs.
You're probably talking
runs.
Like inches. Like
that
if you
is
were to like,
yeah.
What do you call it? Like snap.
Photo finish or something.
Yeah, what do you call it? Yeah, when everyone's Dartfish is called. You can have a program on your computers and like you can layer like different athletes and see their different lines. I mean, you are probably talking like inches to a foot difference.
Okay. What was it like the first ever time you went down one of those runs then? What did you feel like?
You feel everything. You feel fear. You feel exhilaration. Oh my goodness. I mean, yeah. You feel every single emotion.
Were you hooked?
Not after the first
run.
No.
What did your mum say? What did your parents say when you said you were going to do skeleton and your friends?
Oh, we'll support you. Bless them. They're like amazing, my parents. And they just used to drive me to the airport, drop me off.
Hold on. They didn't go... Amy, you're going head first down a...
I don't remember them saying anything. They just were like, okay, like if that's what you want to do, you know, we'll drop you off, say well done. My dad would always be like, be good, do your best. And that's all they would say.
Really? Have you asked them, were they worried about it?
I'm sure they were.
They must have been.
I'm sure they were. And they would always try and watch at least one race a year. And I was so mean to my mum once. I can remember putting her on the corners that you used to crash at.
Oh, wow.
Poor thing. I think they say a little prayer for me.
How do you steer?
You steer through your shoulders. So it's all about weight distribution and the way that those runners dig into the ice and grip. So you're working with the pressures in the corners, so the oscillations of a corner. So a sled would naturally rise and fall throughout a corner. So you're trying to steer the sled with the weight of your shoulders, your head, tapping toes, all to change the direction of the sled.
So your feet actually hit the ground as well, the ice?
Yeah, you don't want to use them much, but sometimes just tapping a toe would just be enough to change an angle.
Wow.
Because you didn't want to use your shoulders because you don't want to go into a skid.
How long does it take to learn that stuff?
Well, years. Yeah. In one sense. It takes years and years to just learn to perfect and find the speed out of each corner.
How long before you made the British team?
Well, I was quite lucky in one sense that I got on it straight away when I first started, because there wasn't really any sort of development program or any of the structure that there was and is nowadays. We were kind of almost the first. There's a few of us who got into the sport by themselves, and we were like the first lot to kind of become a development type of a program. Whereas now we have amazing like Girls for Gold, Discover Your Gold, all these UK sport initiatives to get people into the sport.
What did Germans think about a Brit winning a Winter Olympic sport?
The Germans definitely and the girls want to win this year. They definitely want their medal. But I mean,
yeah, because we own it again at the moment, don't we? We've got it with Lizzie Arnold.
Yeah. She's they're fighting. And to be fair, the Germans are very strong at the moment.
But what did all the nations think? You know, you're a Brit. We've got no right to win a gold medal. You were the first one to win a gold medal for 30 years, weren't you?
Yeah.
Did everyone just look around going, what is she doing winning this medal?
I don't think so. Because when you're in your own sport, I mean, week on week, like I say, you're racing week on week. You see who's winning. You're all one massive family. So the Germans, the Canadians, the Americans, the Aussies, so whoever's competing, you see who's good week on week. Someone wins one week, the next person wins the other. So when it comes to an Olympics, you've almost got your own predictions as to who might win, who's been doing well in the training, who's got the fastest training time. So it almost doesn't come as a surprise. You might get a few people mixing around or suddenly someone comes out of nowhere, but you kind of know who's been doing well throughout the last racing season.
Did you think you could win the gold going down in there?
Yes, I did think I could. I knew I could definitely win a medal, but I kind of never let my brain think about it. Right. Because I was just like, if I don't do the process goals, you know, don't do those simple things every day, get on the sled and do the same old thing, then you're not going to win the medal anyway. So I never let myself think about it.
Amazing though when you won, wasn't it? Because the whole country was like, who's Amy Williams? And suddenly everyone knew who you were.
Yeah.
And you get an award off the Queen or the Royal Family. Yeah. What'd you get, an MBE or something?
Got an MBE.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool, isn't it?
I was a bit sad that the Queen didn't give it to me.
Oh no.
It's potluck.
Who gave it to you?
So I had Princess Anne.
Oh, it's still an MBE though, isn't
amazing.
It? More than I've got.
Oh yeah, I mean, going to the palace, dressing up, taking your parents, just, I'll never forget that day.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Phenomenal.
Yeah, representing our country. And the whole country gets excited because someone's done something good in wearing our colours.
That's the power of sport,
isn't it?
It's that kind of, it really does bring everyone together and everyone's shaking hands, everyone's better for it. And, you know, that's what sport's for, in my opinion.
I do say this because a lot of people always say we buy our medals. So, like, the cycling and the rowing and everything else because we're investing a lot of money. But a lot of other countries are trying to do it as well. And they fail. We're actually pretty good at doing that. So
every other nation is doing exactly the same thing. We're not doing anything different, really. I mean, we might have been doing it just before or, you know, people are talking about it more. But every nation is doing the same thing. Mm. And, you do have to put money into the sports. But it's still down to that athlete beasting themselves in the gym or on the bike or in the swimming pool every single day. It's down to that athlete.
Is the skeleton one mentally as well as physically? Is it a mental thing when you stand at the top of the track about to come down?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You could have 10 athletes who are physically the same, could squat the same, could sprint the same 30-meter time. But who's going to stand at the top, mentally be stronger than the others? Stay consistent, like I said, don't let anything else affect them. Have a good run, have a bad run, but who can keep it all together in the head? And I think it does. And when you're at an Olympics, it's the pressure that you put on yourself as an athlete, the pressure for the team. Like in Vancouver, we knew we had to get a medal. Someone, man or woman, had to win a medal, had to bring it home to keep the funding for the sport to exist and keep going. So there's a lot of pressure on you as an athlete and to justify the money that had been spent on research and development.
The difference half a second makes to your life is amazing, isn't it, really, when you think about it?
I hope I got those timings right. I'm going to be like Googling, like, oh, what was my race time like?
But if you get, or whatever it is, we know it's a tiny amount of time, because you come back without a medal, your life's completely different, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't get the MBE, and you know, no one knows who you are, and you've done all that training, you come home and suddenly you've got a fantastic career since then. Mm. One of the things which interested me was the fact that you decided after throwing yourself down a mountain, you thought you would, or a track, you decided to get into rally driving. Yeah. So you decided to become a co-driver for Tony Jardine, is that
yeah.
And I don't know anything about this sport, so...
Nor did I.
Why did you do it, and what does a co-driver do? Let's start with why on earth you decided to get in a car hurtling around mountains. Well, what do they write? Tracks, isn't it?
Yeah, well, Tony just got in contact with me and was like, hey... Fancy trying to compete in the Wales Rally GB.
Why did he get in contact with you?
Well, I think, you know, he'd seen me. And basically, it all started because I'd gone on a League of Their Own with James Corden. Mm-hmm. And as part of one of the shows that I went on, we did a little tiny feature in rally cars. So we had we were split into teams between driving and then co-driving. Yeah. And it was some silly little game, who can be the fastest round this little track that they'd made. And I happened to be the co-driver. And it was, oh my goodness, I can't think of his name, but one of the rally drivers who was there basically said, oh, actually, Amy was really good.
Right.
Tony had happened to be watching that, click, 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 was like, ooh, let's ask Amy. And so he asked me, and I was like, yeah, you know what? It's a challenge. It's a new skill. I never say no to anything, pretty much. So we had to... Oh my goodness, we spent months. I had to get my license. So in order to get my license to compete on an international level, I had to go around, you know, we were in darkest, deep depths of Wales, in the fog, in the mist, 5 a.m., whatever it was. So I had to do 5 rallies and compete them, and, you know, get someone to tick off that we survived, we got to the finish line, and then I qualified to get my international license.
What does a co-driver do?
Everything. Like, no joke, it was mind-boggling about how much you had to do. So it's like the driver has all the skills, clearly, but the driver will sit in the car, but the co-driver has to tell them when to sit in the car, what to do, where to drive. So you're kind of like the manager of the team, because every second you get penalised if you... go a second too early into, can't even remember all the technical words, but to the marshals to get stamps and times, and you have all your timing cards. So when you get to a stage, so the forest stage, for example, yeah, a second too early, a second too late, and you're penalised. So then you've got to shout out all your pace notes, telling the driver exactly where to go, what to do, shouting out all of your commands.
So
at the same
time,
you're still doing all the timings.
So what are the commands? Give us an example of a command you're shouting.
So it's all different depending on what the driver likes, but we did, for example, you'd say, oh, my brain's even like, what is it? So like L1 over crest 90, 180 or something. So L would be left corner, right. Or R for right. One, he would then know the severity of how steep the corner was. So 1 to maybe 6. 1 for him was a really, really sharp corner, like a hairpin. So 1 was almost like, I imagined it being in like first gear.
Right.
So if I shouted out 5, he would know, pretty much being fifth gear, flat out, foot down, it's pretty much a straight line.
Right.
A crest, you know, flat out, you might not be able to see bump.
So you have to go around the day before, do you?
Yes, no, you recce it.
With
you,
him.
You go at a slower speed, recceing it, writing the notes, him shouting it out. Or you might see a massive rock and you're like, okay, don't cut, like on the inside, because you could cut, you know, get the wheel. Or... then you have night stages, so you're not going to be able to see things as much. So you're trying to write and memorize bits.
So you're putting your hands in... He's putting his hands in your ability to read.
And I'm putting my life in his ability to drive and listen. And then, you know, you have to go through to get the car checks.
Amy, that's dangerous.
And like, but I loved it, because for me, it was having a teammate. It was actually, I'm part of a team here. So clearly, as a skeleton, you're part of a wider team, but it's you as an individual lying on the sled. And I loved...
Yeah, but you were in control. Now you're not in control. Because I couldn't do it. How did you feel not being in control? I think that probably says quite a lot about me.
I didn't really think about it. I think it's the utmost trust. I mean, Tony is as safe. He's not a 19-year-old kid not having no experience and wanting to make fame. Like, I wouldn't have probably got in a car with an inexperienced. Tony has done it for years and years and is a solid, steady, great driver. So I just trusted him and I loved it. I mean, it was the toughest thing I have ever done.
Pressure.
But I loved it, like really loved it. And like the speed didn't worry me because actually the corners come to me quicker on a skeleton sled than they did in a rally car, even though we're kind of traveling faster. Yeah. So I was like, yeah, whatever. Like I was car sick. Like, oh my word. Trying to read pace notes and looking out the window. I was on travel sickness pills because I've done it twice now. So I took 2 years off and then I did it again in 2016. And I was just like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this again?
What did your parents think about this one?
Oh, here she goes again.
They're like, yes, she's retired from the skeleton at last. Yeah. And now like, oh no, she's getting in a car and driving really fast around the forest at
the
night.
On the flip side, like I had, what, a 5 belt, you know, you were seat belt in.
Yeah.
You had a roll cage.
Right.
And I'm like, hang on, I'm safer in this rally car than I am on a skeleton sled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
I love it. I love a challenge. Like, yeah. If someone says, right, Amy, I've got this challenge for you.
Would you do more stuff then? I mean, not obviously compete at that level, maybe, but would you do more challenges like that?
Yeah, I do love, I mean, clearly, I do still like to train. I still like to try and beast my body and accept either I'm going to be in pain or if it's for a short amount of time. Yeah. So I did the the L'Étape de Tour. It's a big cycling show that we did, Tour de Célèbre.
Oh, right,
so that
yeah.
was to do a stage at the Tour de France mountain stage. And I was like, okay, it's 3 months to learn how to cycle, to get fit. My knees did hurt, but I was like, stuff it.
Yeah,
I'm going to get fit. It's an amazing experience. Be part of a team. Get great coaching. Do it.
And because I did a cycle from Belgium to London. And so I had, I think, 6 months to get fit. And I did it. I hated the training on a bike. Did you enjoy it or not?
I hated it to begin with because I was falling off, you know, your cleats, your shoes.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, the amount of times that I was scared stiff of coming up a hill because I couldn't ever unclip quick enough and I'd fall over. So, I mean, I was black and blue, like in pieces. And I actually hated going downhill on a bike because
fear. Oh, hold on. You were going down head first on a...
exactly. But on a bike,
it's
I was
terrifying,
too high.
Isn't
I was
it?
Too high off the tarmac, you know, whereas I'm used to being closer.
Yeah.
Tarmac, if you fall off,
I hate to say
so
this, but
bad.
For any of the cyclists out there listening to this, but for me, it was when I looked down once at the tyre and thought, those tyres are really thin. If there's a nut or something like on the road, you know, like a nut
and
bolt type thing.
A tiny pothole that you fly over the handlebars.
They're going to go, and then I'm going down this, and I'd look at the people, the really good ones going fast. And when we do it as well, often, they don't close the roads off either.
No.
So there's cars coming the other way.
I really hated going downhill. I almost preferred going uphill, slogging your guts off, than going downhill. And actually, in the day of the event, I mean, going downhill, I saw people's tires blow up.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw accidents. There were
helicopters
and ambulances and all sorts. It was frightening.
Did you have to do any cobbles?
The
pain. Anyone who cycles will know this. The pain of going on cobbles.
I can only imagine.
Everything hurts. Like your arms hurt. Your neck hurts. It's just dung, 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 dung. And the other thing I really struggled with was the calorie intake. You have to keep on eating calories. Yeah. And I was like, I felt the insides of me were exhausted as well from just eating constantly to try and
keep
the calories
up. Eating at one, like a mouthful every 20 minutes.
Yeah.
I put something in my mouth.
There was a pro BMX rider when I was doing it there who was helping us and lead through. So he was a very good cyclist. And people laughed at me because I'd never be more than 3 inches away from his back tire. Because obviously, you know, if you're in the what do you call it? The
slipstream.
You're cycling a lot less than everybody else. I just sat in there time. Every day I'd just find his back wheel and I'd stay there. You went on after doing that, or since you've retired, you've been in broadcasting. You've done some amazing things, haven't you? The Gadget Show, you obviously do the coverage for the Olympics and things, Ski Sunday, you did the jump. Are you enjoying broadcasting?
I've been really fortunate and really lucky to be asked to do all these different things, and I've always just said yes, I'll give it a go, and if they don't like me then I won't be asked again. And I've just remained being me. I'm not pretending, or I've never pretended to be someone else. So I feel like if I'm just genuine and me all the time, then I just plod on and see what comes to me. So I've really enjoyed it. It's different. It's I've never been taught. I've never been on media training. I've never been taught how to be behind the camera or anything. And I'm always wanting feedback. I'm always like, did I do all right? Like, how was I? Tell me what I could do a bit better.
So, I think the secret to broadcasting is to be nice and be honest, and that's it.
Yeah.
And if people believe you, because you're a nice person, I think it generally works. We worked together once, didn't we, on Samsung. What did we do? I can't even remember. I was trying to think
about
it.
Yeah, that was...
It was years ago, wasn't it?
It was before London. Or was it before London?
No.
Was it that long ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't even know. But yeah,
we had to do something. I can't remember.
I remember being in some kind of warehouse.
Yeah, it was something to do with phones or something. I can't remember.
And then didn't
we end up at Stamford Bridge as well for a day?
Probably.
I can't remember. What did
and
we
that's
do?
The funny thing, right? You meet people like yourself once in a while, every few years, you suddenly spend the day together doing something random, and then you don't see that person for another few years. And then
there was us that Mark Foster was doing it as well.
Yes, Mark Foster, who's hopefully coming on this soon.
But I remember every time I meet anyone who does anything like a sport or something, I say, give me a tip.
Yeah.
But I didn't know what to ask you because
I
didn't ever imagine I was going to come down.
Hey, manure bag, stuffed with. Newspaper is what we used to go down when we found snow on a hill in our back garden.
Really?
Yes. Okay. That's my tip.
So let's talk about the Olympics because you're gonna be reporting on it for us, the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. Am I saying that correctly,
yes.
Do you think? Starts Friday, the 9th of February.
Yeah.
It's Friday, right? Next Friday.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited about it. How good are we going to be this time round? We don't have great expectations in the country. How what do you think?
I believe we are taking our best ever team.
Oh, good.
I really think that. We've got 59 athletes going, so it's our biggest ever winter team. And I really do think we've got some athletes who, if they all perform on the day, we could be bringing home 5, 6, 7 medals. We've got Skeleton, we've got Lizzie Arnold and Laura Dees, who both on the day are skilled enough to be able to bring home a medal. Whether it happens, I don't quite know. We've got all the snowboarders that we mentioned, so Katie Ormeroyd, Amy Fuller, Billy Morgan, they've all been winning World Cup medals, World Champs medals. Curling, Eve Muirhead, she's got a phenomenal girl team at the moment, and they definitely are wanting to improve on the silver that they've got in Sochi. Then who else we got? I mean, skiing. We've been bringing home medals in the skiing. So we've had Dave Ryden, our slalom specialist, and also we've had Andrew Musgrave. He brought home some medals in the Nordic.
So it sounds like it's going to be an exciting thing for us to watch. We can support people, basically.
I can't remember what the UK sport medal target was, but I think it was something like 5 medals.
Right.
And I really, truly believe, like, if everything happens for those athletes on the day, they don't let the pressure get to them, we have got a chance to bring home the most amount of medals.
What will you be reporting on? Obviously, you'll be doing the skeleton. What other things?
Yes.
Will you get to do some of the other sports as well?
Yeah, I'll have to see. So I'm going to be in the studio in Media City, sat with, like, Claire Bolden, for example, on the opening ceremony on the 9th of February. And then, so I've just got to find out what the schedule is. So what I'm going to be doing for the few days there in Media City, I think probably I might be commentating or talking a little bit about the luge and what to look out for. And then flying out to Korea, and it is mostly solely the skeleton because it's the men and the women.
What's the time difference? Is it a bad one for us?
9 hours, I want to say.
So are we not going to be able to, what is it, in the middle of the night or something?
So you'll have to tune in to BBC, from the morning. So I know like Claire, for example, is on BBC One from I think 10 a.m. to 1:30. Then there's going to be a highlight show in the evening, BBC One, BBC Two. So we will be trying to show as much as possible. Or you can flick over to Eurosport, and then they've also got channels that are going to be running.
And what's the atmosphere like when you're at Olympics, when you're actually a competitor?
There is a weird buzz when you're in an Olympic environment. It's all those years coming down to that one moment. You've been selected, you're walking into that opening ceremony behind your flag. It hits you then that, oh my word, I'm at the Olympics.
And so what nations love it the most? Is it the Germans and the Northern European ones and stuff?
I mean, there are more Alpine nations.
Yeah.
For example, if you're a speed skater and you live in Czech Republic, I mean, you're multimillionaire, like everyone knows you. If you're a skier and you're from Switzerland, you know, so yeah, there are clearly the Alpine nations who it's flipped around. You're more famous if you're a winter sport athlete than a summer. But I think year on year, there's different nations that bring out athletes, and you're surprised that they've got someone competing.
I can't wait. I love it. Oh, I love the speed skating.
I can't wait to watch Elise Christie. Like, she is on fire. She's been winning so many medals. She just missed out 4 years ago on winning her gold medal, and she could win one or two this time round.
My favourite, though, is I think they're called ski cross and board cross, where because I've always said, why don't they all start at the top and the first one down wins? And everyone always went, oh, that's funny. Then they started doing it.
Yeah.
And it's actually brilliant. It's because I just...
Amazing.
And what I love so much about the snowboarding one is you're quicker on your toes than your heels. So the driver, the riders, whatever they're, the boarders, they ride different ways around. So some ride traditional and some ride, goofy. And so they go quicker down the hills at different stages. Mm. And that's what I think, because the ski, obviously you're just going down the hill front way, so they're going down sideways.
Yeah.
I love it. So if the first, you know, if the first bend you're on your toes, you might get an advantage, but then the other guys are going to come back. So I just think it's
fascinating.
I mean,
that's the winter sports to me. Oh, everyone brilliant. Gets excited when they talk about winter sports, Winter Olympics. We love it. We love watching it. It's so exciting.
Yeah, it
is. And you do, you've got these crazy, and like, for example, James Woods Woodsy, he does the ski slope style. I mean, it's phenomenal.
Oh,
watching them do their acrobatics in the air, like higher than a double-decker bus, landing them. Like, it's just phenomenal, all of it. So it's
fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very excited.
Okay, I've got some questions I ask all the guests who come on our podcast. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
I think for me, and it took me a long time to learn it, is to trust and listen to my gut. Trust that feeling, what it says inside of you, and if it's saying yes or no, do it, don't do it, then just listen to it.
Okay. What example of that? Have you got an example of that? Have you got one where you went and you dodged a bullet or something?
Well, I guess for me, for example, in the racing in Skeleton, we had these new runners for the sleds that were just designed, but we just didn't have time to test them properly just before the Olympics. Right. And I tested them out on Lake Placid where we were doing a holding camp, and I crashed. I scared myself. I didn't like it. The coaches really wanted me to use them because of the money and the research and development, and we needed to be seen to be using them. But my gut was like, no, I want to stick to my old trusty favourites. I don't want to change something a week before the Olympics. Got to the Olympic track. It was crazy fast.
Yeah.
They still wanted me to use it, and my gut was just... And I remember crying on the phone home. Like, Mum, like, I feel the pressure, the team, but my gut says no. Like, and I'm so pleased I just listened to my gut and just do what you knew was right inside.
What mistake do people make? Maybe doing your job or something. What mistake
have
you seen?
I guess if we're maybe going along the same theme, is you get so much advice from so many people, and I think listening to advice is really, really important. Right. But also remembering that you can make your own decision as well, and listening to advice, taking what you need to, and then going back to that gut feeling of your decision.
Any life hacks? Might be
life hacks. Well, I'm going to go along the traveling theme. Rolling up your clothes is always a good one when it comes to creases and space. So I roll up all my clothes and pop them all in my suitcase.
Good idea.
That's quite a good one.
Yeah. What's it like to be famous?
Well, I don't think I am. And I don't feel like I am. So I'm like, I'm not. I'm just me.
Oh, no. I was out with some parents from my kid's school last night, and I said, oh, I'm interviewing you tomorrow. And they went, oh, brilliant. They all know who you are, and they all know that you won the gold medal. So
I think
famous.
For me, like, if you speak to sports fans, winter sports fans, then people know who you are. If you talk to someone, like, I wouldn't know soap stars on the TV because I don't watch soaps. I wouldn't know someone from Carnation Street EastEnders because I don't watch it. So I think it's the same kind of thing. If you're a fan of that subject or whatever, you know who people are, and if you don't, you don't.
Right, okay. And the final question, what's the meaning of life, Amy?
Oh, being happy. Happiness. Waking up, trying to have a smile on your face. Which is hard when you've maybe had a screaming baby all night, etc. But yeah, I think looking around you, realizing we are so fortunate, we are so lucky to have a roof over our head and food on our plates to feed ourselves every day. So yeah, being grateful.
How are you getting on being a mum? Biggest challenge yet?
I know I've left my little baby behind. It is the biggest challenge. It's the most amazing challenge. It's magical. One day can be the most phenomenal, magical day. Yeah. And at the same time, you could be crying because like yesterday, he found the cat water. He eats the cat food. I keep telling him to move away. He puts his hand in the cat water, but there's nowhere in our house to really move the cat food. So I'm trying to teach him that's not for you. The cat and him are like best buddies, but he found his little shoe and put his shoe into the cat water. I had to change him 3 times because he was soaked through with the said cat water. Yeah, I mean, stuff like that. You've just got to smile your way through it.
Yeah, I think every stage, I always say this, because we give a lot of advice to people on this, every stage is a very short period of time.
Yeah.
So when they're annoying you by not sleeping or doing something like that, it's really short
it's
period
minimal.
Of time. You know,
he's adorable. Like, yeah, he's with his granny at the moment. So. He's amazing. So, yeah, I'm very lucky. He is the
Amy,
best
thank you
had.
So much for coming on today.
Thank you.
I will be tuning in on the 9th, and I can't wait for it. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.